Now, I am delighted to welcome back to Northside Today good friend and regular contributor, Breed Smith, TD, People Before Profit. Good morning, Breed, and welcome to Northside Today.
Good morning, Donny, and thank you.
You're more than welcome. Breed, I want to get down to the reason for our chat today. One of my favourite subjects, money. And you have are a member of a Dáil committee which is looking into, I suppose the best way to describe it for our listeners is the reallocation maybe of TB licence money, but you have some issues with where some of that money may be reallocated to.
Yeah, I mean, we were lobbied quite strongly by the industry, the broadcasting industry, to have a look at giving 20% of the broadcasting licence fee to, I think it was 20% if my figures are correct, to the independent radio stations for the provision of news and public interest affairs, and that's fine, and you know, in the sort of scale of things, one would say, look, community radio like yourselves, and to be honest, community radio like yourselves that is regular and fit for purpose and all the rest isn't that regular. It's what they call commercial radio stations are the normal throughout the country, and most of them are provided their news by the company run by Dennis O'Brien, which is like all they do is provide news, and they are the ones that are lobbying hardest for this funding. So indirectly, your broadcasting license would be funding Dennis O'Brien's enterprises, and I just think that there's something sinister and wrong about that, and I'm opposed to it.
Now, Bridge, one thing that's, because it's something that I would have a little bit of knowledge about, and I suppose coming from the community radio sector of the industry, let us say, the likes of, we'll say, FM 104, News Talk, 98 FM, any of those radio stations around the country, they are entitled, while they're not entitled to TB licence money, they are entitled to fundraise or revenue stream by advertising, whereas community stations, by the terms and condition of the licence, are not allowed to advertise. Yes, we do promos for our own programmes and stuff that we're doing ourselves, but we are not allowed to go out into the marketplace and actively canvass for advertising with big companies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it seems to me that even if you're slightly successful with your amendments that you're trying to bring forward here, the balance of things is still going to be skewed in favour of the commercial entities. And that's before we even talk about RTE, who have the licence fee and are entitled to advertise.
Well, you raise an interesting point, and I think something has to be done to help community radio to stay alive and indeed to thrive. When I first met you, you worked in a community radio outfit in West Dublin, and that struggled for its survival because of what you've just described, which is the inability to revenue raise independently. So I think more has to be done to support community radio, and I think we also have an amendment to that effect. But I disagree with the idea that the so-called struggling commercial stations should be given more support and more funding, and particularly public funding, because actually I don't believe that many of them are struggling that much. Now, there are many voices of commercial radio dotted throughout rural Ireland who possibly do struggle a bit more, but as you say, they are entitled to revenue raise and to advertise, and they certainly do that on a grand scale. So I don't believe that public money should be gone further, as I say, to this particular outfit, to Dennis O'Brien's outfit, which provides the news and current affairs to a large percentage of these commercial stations.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, that's before we even go into the amount of actual radio stations and publications that certain people own. And I mean, it seems to me that the vast majority of them are probably in the hands of three organisations. You've probably Dennis O'Brien, you've the Crosby Group, and as I say, you've the state broadcaster, and after that you're struggling for ownership.
That's correct. And it's like monopolising the media, which is a very unhealthy thing for to happen, and it can happen by default or design. And in this case, I think it's a mixture of both. But I don't think we should design any more mechanisms to support that domination and saturation of the media by a certain minority.
And Breage, that brings me very, very nicely to the next point that I wanted to raise with you, which is, you know, you, because of your job, basically, as a TD, and I suppose me, because of what I do for a crust, we would be media literate insofar as we would maybe not take everything for gospel that we read, hear, or see. But the ordinary person on the street, and I don't wish to demean the citizenry of Ireland, they wouldn't be as media literate or as media savvy as us. So, I mean, they would take as gospel what they read, hear, and see, and you wouldn't expect them to be. So there is the possibility there maybe to manipulate a story, maybe. Would that be the polite way of putting it, Breage?
Well, there's no doubt, and it's not a hidden secret that the media often dictate the narrative in society and shape the ideas that people have in their heads. I would say, though, that that's beginning to change, and we saw it changing very dramatically during the movement against the water charges in this country, where the awareness of political life and the way the society is set up has had changed for a lot of people, and social media now plays a role in that as well. But there again, one can't believe everything one reads on social media, because an awful lot of stuff is put out there which is total lies, variants from total lies to spin to distortion of the truth. So you have to be careful how you question and deal with the media, and that's why I think it's important that people have access to all sorts of media, that it's not dominated by any one set of ideology, and that you can, you know, make your mind up by looking around and hearing different points of view. And often, if the media is controlled by one or two certain individuals, that can be a distortion of the facts.
Breage, it's a very interesting point you raise there, and I suppose we are in the shadow now of the local and the European elections coming up on the 23rd of May. And I'm just wondering, Breage, and I'd be interested in your opinion on this. You and I, and anybody with an interest in this, has seen, I would suggest maybe over the last 5-7 years, a massive growth in the input of social media around election time. And I'm just wondering, Breage, how big a role do you think social media will play in the upcoming elections?
Well, insofar as individual candidates promote themselves on social media, I think it plays quite a role, and I think every candidate is aware of that and puts a lot of effort and time into explaining their politics, their position, what they advocate for through social media, and I think that's a good thing, provided it's used in a healthy way and not in the sort of disturbing, you know, trying to promote ideas of hate or prejudice against any group of people. Social media will play a role. Indeed, it will play a role in the promotion of the politics of various candidates. It does play a role in showing what are they doing for their community, within their community or within society. Where are they active? How are they portraying themselves? Are they engaging with local people? Are they trying to change things? Are they trying to make gains for their community? All of that stuff. And I think from that point of view, it's a very useful tool, because no candidate, particularly of the smaller groups and independents and small parties, would get the type of exposure from the mainstream media that social media can give them. And in a way, that gives others, if you like, the category of others, a chance to make a breakthrough in the local and European elections.
And of course, as well, Breage, outside of exposures, they won't have the financial wherewithal either, because your funding is based on your representation in Parliament, isn't that right?
That's right, Donny, very good point. But also, the bigger parties and the more establishment parties are more likely to get funding from corporate and bigger financial interests. They're more likely to receive donations from those quarters. Those donations are limited under legislation, but nevertheless, the money is more likely to go their way than it is to smaller groups and smaller parties.
Bridge, I am very grateful to you for your time this morning, because I know that, you are tight on time. But before I let you go, I have to ask you about the shenanigans in the British Parliament. And I was watching a TV debate that you were involved in last night, and I think it's pretty safe to say that you are still not sold on the idea that when push comes to shove, Europe will back us all the way through this Brexit debacle.
I certainly am, and I never was. I never really fully trusted the likes of Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker, because their interests are not in pity little Ireland and the sort of contribution that we make to Europe. Their interests are in big corporations, in the European Central Bank, in the sort of stuff that European business is made of, and indeed of the heavy trading and the heavy lifting that is done by commercial interests. I don't really accept that they understand or get or think that Ireland and the existence of the hard border, the possible existence of a hard border in Ireland, really matters that much. To me and to others, we realise what this could do to this country, the implications it may have. We realise that a hard Brexit could really impact on jobs. My local butcher, for example, the lads in my local butcher up the walls about their own jobs. They think that this is a disaster because Theresa May revealed the sort of tariffs that she would put on Irish agricultural imports. And I think that there has to be guarantees from Europe, and they have to be almost declared by Leo Varadkar that there will be no hard border, that Europe will not impose one, and that Leo Varadkar himself has to declare that his government will not impose one. They'll have nothing to do with the imposition of a hard border, and should anyone attempt to impose one, that he would conduct a national border poll to say, do we want a hard border? And the best way not to have a hard border is to get rid of the border permanently. And that's why we would be advocating a border poll that would show both North and South that the desire of the people of this country, never mind what happens in Britain, is to maintain a seamless, borderless country that can trade and deal both sides of it with each other in a peaceful way. And I think that's really important. And I don't think Europe gets it. And I don't believe Leo Varadkar is doing enough to ring-fence that and to guarantee that for us. He hasn't declared it. He hasn't put his heart on his sleeve. And he hasn't told us that he will not implement a hard border, no matter what. And we need to hear that.
But, Bridge, can I just bring you back there to one of the points you made? But, and it's probably, possibly, and I would say almost certainly, our saving grace is that Ireland, as in the Republic of Ireland, Britain, Europe and America, as far as I'm aware, America signed up or signed to it as well, are co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement, which is an international treaty lodged with the UN. So even if Europe wanted to take the easy way out and re-establish or see a border re-established between the six counties, or a hard border re-established between the six counties and the Republic, by virtue of the Good Friday Agreement, they can't. And this is the whole problem, that they're caught between a rock and a hard place. They can turn neither left nor right.
Well, you see, I think you have to distinguish. The Good Friday Agreement is a political agreement that reflects the aspirations of the people of this country. The agreement with the European Union is about trades and tariffs and customs, and it doesn't actually see the political political ambition in the same way. And that's why I think it is at risk, and why we do need the guarantees, because you're looking at two different types of real politics and how they deal with each other. And the Good Friday Agreement absolutely is an aspiration and an agreement reflecting politics, but what the EU want is tariffs and customs and trade deals. And if they don't get it, there's no guarantee that they won't push the Irish government to implement a hard border or attempt to do so themselves. I'm not convinced that they won't throw us under a bus.
Well, Bridge, we know one another a long time, and the only thing I can say to you on that is I sincerely hope you're wrong, because I think that the ramifications of that would be unspeakable, I think, is the phrase I'd use.
No, I agree with you, Donny. I sincerely hope I'm wrong too, but I'd be very reassured if the Taoiseach would make a declaration to that effect, but he's refusing to do so.
Breedge, as somebody who often draws on your experience from your previous life, and as somebody now who has been involved in some pretty hot and heavy debates in on the floor of Dáil Éireann, do you ever stop and reflect on those two aspects of your life as you look at what's going on in the Parliament in England and try and make sense of it? Because in fairness, we have had some pretty, how would I put it now diplomatically again, we have had some pretty extraordinary goings on in Dáil Éireann, and I know, like, as a union, trade union activist and that you would have been involved in a lot of negotiations. But this has to be way beyond anything that any of us have ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, I see similarities, by the way, in what's going on with Britain. So, I mean, I'm not being opportunistic in saying this, but the Speaker of the House has accused the Prime Minister of trying to present the same package in the same way, and that he's not going to let her do it. And he in turn is accused of using arcane mechanisms that go back to the late 1600s on standing orders to say that you can't do this and you can't keep doing the same thing. I see parallels in that because I'm involved in trying to get past a climate emergency measures bill, which would instruct the Minister for Energy not to issue any more exploration licences for gas or fuel unless there's evidence that our carbon emissions are being reduced. And that bill is being blocked actively by the Minister for Energy and Communications and the Environment and what I call climate inaction, Richard Bruton. It's being blocked positively and energetically by the chairperson, Fine Gael TD, who's the chairperson of the committee. And it's being held in the limbo. And it's been there's no precedence for this. And that's what the Speaker of the House said the other night to Theresa May. There's no precedence for what you're doing under standing orders. There's no precedence for what's happening to my bill under standing orders, but yet they continue to impose it. So parliaments play tricks and they play games and they use standing orders and they use procedural mechanisms to hold back democracy in a way that's actually quite incredible. That's what's happening in Britain. But there's a further thing happening in Britain which is very interesting. I tried to get that point across last night, but Colin Brophy kept interrupting me. And that is that the interesting thing about Britain is we are watching the implosion of an empire on whom the sun never set at one point. It is now in deep, deep crisis. And this crisis is being reflected in what's happening in Westminster. They don't know which end is up. And really, it's reflective of their economic and political paralysis on a global scale compared to what they've been used to for the last few hundred years. Britain was the empire for many, many centuries. It is now imploding on itself, and it's very interesting to see that happening. But I think parliaments everywhere play games with the whole notion of democracy, and they use procedural mechanisms in the way that they want to, and I've seen that firsthand. But Britain, you're right about what you say, this is unprecedented. But because it is happening in the implosion of what once was a very powerful empire that economically doesn't have the same strength anymore, which is one of the reasons why many of its advocates have been saying, let's get out of this European Union and move towards a different type of free trade, because they want to make Britain great again type of argument. It's a concept of strong competition, political competition as well as economic competition that they want to re-engage in. I think there's many reasons for wanting to get out of Europe, but that shouldn't be one of them, because that's just about an empire that is frustrated at not having the muscle it once had.
Breedge Smith, TD, People Before Profit. Breedge, once again, thank you so much for your contribution. It has been brilliant, and as I say, it only remains for me to thank you for your contribution to Northside today, and I suppose, as Confucius once said, may you live in interesting times, and we certainly are.
Thank you, Donny, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks very much for having me on.
And undoubtedly, the way things are going, Breedge, we will have loads to talk about. Breedge Smith, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, slán.